have we already started?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you light that cigarette, we'll definitely have started.
I mean, is this part of it?
Everything's part of it.
All right. Well, this is the boring part, then. We should get started.
I told you that you don't need to be interesting.
No, I'm not trying to be interesting. I'm trying to make sure we talk about our theatrical futures.
I see.
Okay. So, Murphy.
Con.
We meet again.
It's true. You're in Hong Kong.
I am in Hong Kong. This is an historic day in Hong Kong.
Why is it a historic day in Hong Kong?
Because just 15 minutes ago, the police set up a cordon at Occupy Central, and they're giving the occupiers 2 hours to exit. 7,000 police.
I see. What do you think is going to happen?
Most people are already gone, and they're starting new creative ways of protesting. They're doing something called the shopping tour in Mong Kok, where a lot of mainlanders come to shop. Now protesters show up about 200 strong to the shopping tour and buy super cheap things in the same shops and just shout slogans the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose, it started in 2011 with Occupy Wall Street, and it continues now. And I think it won't go away here. I think the cool thing is these young people, you know, let's say there were 20,000 of them at times, probably somewhere between 1 and 350 will wind up in politics. And, you know, whether it takes 5 or 20 years, there's a lot of, like, 15 and 17-year-olds down there. So, you know, it's pretty guaranteed to have some kind of ripple effect in the generations of political future here. So most people don't see it as a failure because of how energized and serious the students have been, you know. Wow, you have some ice-cold water.
Cheers.
I have some lukewarm water.
Yeah, well, you're a Ayurvedist.
I suppose.
I'm a fan of extreme temperatures myself.
So, Ira.
Aaron.
I think we don't have an agenda per se, but you send me a list of questions.
Right. And you sent me a lot of things that you were thinking about from this position about the future, our theatrical future, yours and mine. Individually.
Yes.
So do you want to...
Yes.
Do you want to start from the future and then talk about future's past? Or do you want to talk about future's past and then talk about future?
Probably future's past. I think, because if I put myself in the shoes of the audience, something like 99% of them will not have seen any of our past work.
That's true. Do you want to characterize what we have made in the past?
Yeah, I do. I presume you enjoyed my sneaking into my email response alone with others and in groups, our first performance together.
That was the first show that we ever did together?
Well, I'm pretty dang sure it was the first thing that I performed in Chicago.
Yeah, that's likely.
So, I mean, I think I performed something in Winnetka in 1978.
When you were 3?
Yeah, at my preschool and kindergarten, we did a black and white photo of me standing on a kid's back with my arms up like this. We were doing kind of a tumbling performance to Rock Around the Clock, I think. you know?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock.
I'm familiar. Mm-hmm.
And then at Christmas time, I sang and danced with a little sparkly helmet on as a twinkle star in Jingle Bell Rock, which might have been 1979. But the 80s, I didn't perform in Chicago at all. And in 1991, I think, autumn 1991, we did Alone With Others and In Groups.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was our first performance together at the Chicago Academy for the Arts. And I suppose the process of making that show might actually bear more on our process than we've ever talked about.
So I don't think we didn't do anything directly together in that show, though, right? Like,
we took the curtain call together.
We took the curtain call together?
Imagine.
Well, we were in that weird, remember, Jesse Weber wrote that play called Brood Decaf, and then instead of actually doing the play Brood Decaf, it was incorporated as a deconstructed staging of the rehearsal of Brood Decaf as the sort of like title cards between each of the sections of the show. I think we were in that together. Uh-huh. And I remember that you were dancing, and there was a line where you, I forget what the whole line was, but at the end you said aim, and I always thought that you were just supposed to be abbreviating the name of a character whose name was Amy, but you always said it sort of out of the blue as if you were aiming at something.
I'd have to check the video archives. I don't recall this.
Because I think the premise was you had too much espresso, right, or too much caffeinated coffee, and so you were out at a nightclub dancing, and you said it was like, yeah, let's get it on, aim, but I always thought you had misread the script, and you were really just supposed to say, like, let's get it on, aim.
Fascinating. I have no recollection of this. I have a slight recollection of dancing, but not the dialogue. But I do think, even though we weren't close at that time, that being my first exposure to the Chicago Academy for the Arts and performance in Chicago might have influenced us somewhat. Not more than the general pedagogy of the faculty, but kind of as a example of the pedagogy or of the open-mindedness. It definitely, you know, there were times in making that project that I felt like this is a terrible, terrible project. Like, this is so stupid.
No, I mean, I think you're right, because it sort of, you know, I mean, we might have used the word performance art. You know, I'm not sure if we did, but it sort of introduced the idea of sort of performance as something larger or more intricate, you know, more complex than dramatic theater, right? And I remember being sort of confused by it too, but I also remember being really excited by it, but what I also remember is that there was this sort of like general, I thought there was a general sort of evaluation that it had been a disaster. And I remember having this kind of sense that that didn't seem right? That didn't accurately portray the experience that I had of it. I remember feeling kind of embarrassed that I thought it was exciting, like that there was something indulgent about my idea that it was exciting, whereas, you know, like everybody else was sort of like, oh, it was a disaster, right?
Yeah, I don't recall the feeling that everyone else thought it was a disaster, but I do think there was something about the energy or the excitement or the relative lack of editorial sort of authority in the making of it that probably did contribute to our aesthetic going forward, sort of from a kind of wild and crazy. I mean, what strung along with others and groups together was almost nothing except that the same young people were performing all those pieces. You know, the concept that it was about being alone or with others or in groups was kind of a long reach.
Well, there was this idea that it was somehow related to the to like a joke about going to like the Catholic school kids would make about going to confession. What's that?
That was
explicit. I mean, I think we originally had a scene of, you know, of that as the title card, and then it got scrapped in favor of the deconstructed version of Jesse Weber's Brood Decaf.
Speaking of which, you know, since my shamanic ceremony days, I haven't really been a caffeine drinker.
That's wild.
And this morning I'm drinking non-decaf. I'm drinking a real coffee.
For the first time since you were in L.A.?
No, I dabble in caffeine sometimes now, in the last maybe 3 months, but partly just because I'm tired this morning.
Yeah.
Very tired, and I want it to be zing!
Why are you tired?
Tatiana got tickets to the last film in a French film festival last night, but the show started at 9:45 p.m., and we went, and when we got back, she wanted to watch Californication, and then we wanted to fornicate. So
I see.
Long night. I also recall in the Academy performance poetry class with Roger Smart as moments where we became closer in artistic friendliness.
The performance poetry class is what I remember as you and I becoming friends and me appreciating your aesthetic.
Yeah, likewise. Likewise, for sure. Though I only recall the shaving poem.
That's all I recall. Well, I recall a couple of your other poems from that class. There was one about the different meanings of the word plant. Like,
oh, I wrote that then.
I think so, yeah.
That was kind of a word jazz Joe Frankie kind of monologue.
Right, it was like you were talking about how there was a plant that grows, a plant like a spy, but also like at a dry cleaner's, there's a plant on premises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got that right here. I actually unpacked a bunch of old poems.
You have it right there, like, taped to your wall?
No, it's in a file somewhere.
Oh, I see. You're looking up as if it was engraved in your ceiling or something. I see.
Strangely, I thought I sent all my journals to Hong Kong in a box, and it never arrived, so I wonder if everything I've ever written is lost, or if I actually sent it to Atlanta instead. But anyway, that's neither here nor
there. Oh, boy. I don't have that stuff. I just have theater stuff.
I doubt you have that stuff. I mean, it would look like a bunch of blank books, you know, a bunch of journals.
I have something. I have some kind of crate with videos and programs and stuff, but I don't know if it has the journals in it. Probably not, because you probably gave it to me as the LEC archive.
Yeah. So I suppose that even though I really didn't premeditate talking about the Academy and these particular experiences, I think we could sort of, you know, draw some loose conclusions about, you know, what launched us into an interest in, you know, theater as a kind of open question, what makes a performance or what makes theater event a theater moment. And I think going as I got towards graduation a year before you, and we had these meetings about forming the Exit Theater Company, I suppose that was the beginnings of our desire, our outwardly expressed desire to collaborate beyond the Academy.
Yeah, I suppose I was just going to say, I was trying to sort of remember when the idea that we were collaborators became clear, and in some ways I was sort of feeling like that didn't happen in high school, but maybe you're right. Maybe I had completely forgotten about the Exit Theater Company. That was sort of...
How could you with all of its productions?
it was very complexly structured.
I still cherish that structure. I still think if I was to become like Jason Peck or Barbara Whitney or Amy Davis, a full-time theater professor, I might try to institute the structure of the Exit Theater Company if I had very, very active, hungry students
who
wanted to make work all the time. I think if I was to settle in a place like Paducah or Bethlehem or some place where the community is small enough that something can occupy that much of people's time, such a structure could work for any kind of community group or school or, you know, semi-pro or whatever. But it's a great structure. Maybe we should put a diagram of Exit in the program as a kind of a footnote.
Do you have those? I remember you had like a pretty nicely designed spreadsheet, you know, not spreadsheet, but like broadside detailing.
I definitely have those in storage somewhere, maybe here, but it's easy to make. You definitely make it. I don't want to dwell too much on the past, and we're still in high school here.
So. No, but I mean, it's such a great example of this kind of, you know, complexly imagined future, right? That, you know, that we put in, you know, that you really put in place this, like, you know, this, like, whole structure of, you know, and we had positions, right? I think it was, you were already, like, the artistic director, and...
I do recall Andy White thinking that it was a wonderful structure, and that we had far more figured out than Looking Glass did when they started it.
Well, that is a great example of the predictive nature of those sorts of things. Just compare us to Looking Glass.
Yeah. Well, we certainly haven't wasted our time getting funding and space and, you know, building an audience as they have.
Or making work.
So, it is a good example, but the meat of our collaborations come later.
So it's true.
If we skip forward to our unhappy times, me at USC and you at NYU, before I transferred to Marlboro, we weren't really thinking or talking about working together all that much, were we?
I don't think so. I mean, although I think you you took the Exit Theater Company idea and brought that to USC, right? And then, and sort of realized it there.
I forgot about that. Yeah, Exit became a USC student organization that the USC Department of Theater really hated, and saw as an almost illegal activity. And then, I recall in 93 or 4, I started adapting Beautiful Losers at USC, with Jason Peck primarily, and then we didn't work on Beautiful Losers till 99, so you were getting your dramatic writing BFA. I was going around from USC to Tel Aviv to Marlboro. I know I started directing when I got my wisdom teeth pulled in the winter of 95, planned the first LEC project called Laboratory for Enthusiastic Collaboration, An Experiment Goes Public, I remember planning that while I was on Vicodin and Advil.
That was when you did The War in Heaven and Cowboy Mouth.
Yeah.
Those shows, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the beginning of the LEC. In March 96 was the first performance. And the LEC went on to do Mud that same autumn. And then I became more of a director because the first Light project was much more collaborative. Yeah, then, okay, so then Living Theater for me. And
well, by the time you were in New York doing your internship with Living Theater, I was already gone because we never were, we didn't live in New York at the same time.
That's weird.
I mean, I think you moved. Did you move into my apartment?
I doubt it. No.
I think for a little while you might have.
Well, I used your apartment several times over the years, but I don't think at that time. Or if so, for a very short transition, maybe. Because it was two different sublets in the West Bed that summer.
Right. No, I remember that, but I thought maybe for a little while you were living in my apartment. But maybe not, because I think maybe Rob and Bonnie were living in my apartment or something.
And that's also around the time we started going to Bread and Puppet.
You hadn't been to Bread and Puppet before that summer?
96 was the first one.
Right. So the only time I ever was at the Domestic Resurrection Circus was that summer in 98, which was the last.
Right.
The last circus.
Right.
And for me, I feel like that's, you know, I don't know about theater per se, but that's like, in some ways, that was when I felt like we sort of like our thoughts about the future recollided in my book. You know, I mean, I think for me, I felt very marginal to everything that you were doing in those intervening years. You know, and you've always had a way, you know, it's part of the, you know, tense dynamic between us, right? Of like, or maybe you haven't had a way, but I've had a way of responding to you as, you know, as if you have a very, like, full, complex, and completely lived life apart from the one that we are currently living together. And so, you know, I think I've always sort of, you know, and that was certainly true in high school, and I think some of it was cultivated secrecy on your part of, like, keeping different parts of your life very separate, not for my benefit, but for Sarah's benefit, I imagine. But, you know, that, like, there were lots of different chambers to the life that you were living. And so I think I had a sense of, like, I don't know if I really knew you or, you know, you went away. I don't think I was upset about the Exit Theater Company, but like per se, but I think I remember sort of feeling like, oh, well, so that's a thing that like I was sort of convenient to at that moment. And then you took it and realized it somewhere else. I don't think I ever was thinking in terms of making work together. You know, I mean, I think I also had this fantasy of myself as this kind of, you know, as a kind of mainstream, like, figure, right? Like, I thought I was going to either be a filmmaker or, like, this kind of, you know, David Mamet, like, playwright or something like that, right? And so, you know, all of, you know, I mean, in some ways I've come into line with what you were interested in then, but I mean, sometimes it's almost like we've switched places, right? Where you've become more interested in, or not, maybe not more interested, but of the two of us, you're more interested in this kind of like spectacle, global circulation, you know, these kinds of things. And I'm the stubborn, you know, person, you know, on the fringe.
I mean, I did have a fairly easy time in my two schools and even in Tel Aviv of getting a group together to do something, which always amazed me and seemed like it was going to be the case for the future and would certainly lead to a career. So I can imagine that.
Yeah, you were making things happen and you had these kind of like really intense groups of people that you were working with.
But it really coalesced with LEC at Marlboro in terms of quality work, or interesting work, work that I was proud of, or felt worth disturbing the community with. Concern.
Sure, I just mean you found yourself in those contexts, continued to find myself, feel like I found myself in, you know, in isolation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then, we were both done with school, and nomadic or semi-nomadic, and then Beautiful Losers, and in some ways, I think Beautiful Losers was our, maybe not in some ways, I think in any way you slice it, Beautiful Losers is our only full-length sort of finished piece, right? Like a piece that isn't, Values Americans Live By without the post-show discussions before and after, you know, sort of during and after is, a 35-minute piece.
I think it was closer to an hour.
Without the internal post-show discussion or the actual post-show
discussion? No, including the internal. The internal post-show discussion was part of the show. From beginning to end, that show was close to an hour. Anyway, it's neither here nor there.
But I do see Beautiful Losers also in terms of, like, you know, story, plot, characters, kind of theater. Literary kind of theater with recognizable roles for the audience, you know, like something that the audience comes and sits down and watches and leaves and says, oh, I saw a piece of theater tonight. Like, that's, I think, the only thing we've made where people can really, you know, say that is, you know, a two-act piece of theater that was made by these guys, and I saw it, and it was called Beautiful Losers. And
yeah, I mean, I think for me, there's a way that Beautiful Losers. I finished college early, right, and then I was already traveling. You finished college at the, like, that spring, I think, right?
Uh-huh.
Is that right? Do we graduate in the same year? Why would we have graduated in the same year?
Because I did an extra year because of Israel. I went to Israel twice.
Oh, yeah. And then that summer was when we went to Bread and Puppet, and then right after Bread and Puppet and that whole experience, which included both puppets and mushrooms in particularly, you know, transformative ways. A few days later, I was in New York at the Westbeth with you and Gretchen, and we had this really long conversation about communities. And that was sort of like, that's what I was saying before, that I feel like was the moment when our futures recollided in, you know, in some way, right? And that conversation generated a lot more conversations over the next year until we ended up at Arcosanti working on Beautiful Losers. But for me, you know, I think Beautiful Losers, when I think about it, I feel like I was still kind of imitating some idea I had of what making theater was like, right? You know, I sort of stumbled my way through it. And then was really happy with the result. But I think when I think back, the Values Americans Live By is to me much closer to a moment when I feel like I discovered something that felt like it was sort of natural to the way I might make performance work, right? So in some ways I feel about the Values Americans Live By similar to the way I remember feeling about Alone with Others and in Groups, right? Which is that everybody else seems to remember it as a disaster, and I remember it as like a uniquely pleasurable accident, you know, in some way.
Mm-hmm. I think with time, more people feel that way. I'm not sure, but I think, but I'm concerned about our time, and us not yet being present, on our way to the future.
Just the one thing I want to say about that is that I think part of what, you know, part of what that discovery was the idea that, like, discomfort could somehow be part of the process, right? It was like...
Well, but it was in Beautiful Losers also.
It was, but I think in Beautiful Losers I still felt, and this was all internal, you know, that I was imagining a more harmonious theatrical process, right? Like, that was, like, what, you know, what we should be doing in some way. And I remember, like, the sense of, like, the shadow, like, that there felt like a shadow process between what we were doing and what Gretchen was doing with 1984, and, like, they had this sort of very, like, you know, what seemed from the outside very harmonious process that I felt somehow vindicated when things fell apart for them in Montreal. That their sort of like agreement to only work out of a place of pleasure, and like we were living in so much strife and poverty and angst and everybody angry at each other all the time. But we still managed to make the show happen. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's something about like that somehow like making space for that tension and argument and disjuncture, different ideas of what the piece should be in within the piece that happened with Beautiful with The Values Americans Live By.
Well, yeah, I think you know that I appreciate when the audience scratches their head and asks if they came into the right theater or if this is what they came for, and that's what I really enjoyed about Values Americans Live By. And Exotic Products also had, I even can hear when I listen on headphones to the audience before the show starts in the pre-show business of Exotic Products, I actually hear someone say, is this a performance or a lecture? I hear someone say, like, is this a performance or a seminar? And, you know, we're very into that. But what I like about Beautiful Losers is that when the audience is scratching their heads, it's not wondering if they're in the right place or if they're experiencing what they were supposed to experience, but rather trying, the same way that I was while I read the novel, trying to understand what are the given circumstances of this universe. And I think the way Beautiful Losers is just Trunks and Fracture actually is inspired by the writing style and by the novel, and because we believed in the writing style of the novel and the story, the text, the characters, etc., I think we succeeded to do what maybe no adaptation had done before with that, which is essentially to bring it, you know, in one way or another, to bring that psychedelic novel to the stage.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think that, you know, for me, Beautiful Losers is a, like, Beautiful Losers, the text was the novel, and, you know, we went through this process of adaptation and rehearsal to stage the novel and the fictional world of the novel, and with The Values Americans Live By, the text was the rehearsal process, and we went through this rehearsal process in order to make a piece that was set in the space of the theater at the moment that, you know, that it was happening, right? And that's ended up being kind of what I, you know, what I get excited by in my own work and in my own, you know, research now, right, is work that, yeah, work that does that. So for me, and, you know, just for me as a individual, that was the moment of discovery, right? And it was like this really weird thing that I think, you know, I didn't have, you know, we hadn't seen Goat Island's work yet, and, you know, and I had never, you know, I certainly knew of the Worcester Group, but I had never seen the Worcester Group, you know, and then when we moved back to Chicago, you know, some people who saw Values Americans Live By told, you know, compared it to the Worcester Group, and we went to see House Lights in New York that year, and we saw Goat Island for the first time, and, you know, and I felt like we had sort of, like, stumbled on some ways of making work that, you know, that aligned with what we had kind of discovered out of necessity and by accident, right?
Yeah, yeah. But definitely there is something super exciting about that discovery, and there is something really exciting about that sense that our sort of strange way of making work is not without reference points or context or community or, that's huge. And I feel like, you know, I haven't thought about it in a long time, but yeah, but that period of time was very, very exciting, for that reason. And I think the cool thing about Values Americans Live By each time it's been produced is how it does seem to recreate a weird kind of presence in the space. But that brings us to about 2004 or 7 at the closest. and I think the title of your performance, re-performance tonight, asks us to talk about the future. We have 2 minutes, roughly.
We could take a little bit more than 2 minutes, I think.
But I suppose since we lived together in the apartment you're in right now, which was 2005 to 2007, first of all, this piece, which we performed in 2015, is the first piece we've made since Robert's Rules of Order, right?
Mm-hmm. Probably, yeah.
That's bullshit. Because I love you more than personal space.
You love me more than personal space?
Yes. I saw that on the t-shirt of someone here in Hong Kong. Yeah.
I was going to say, do you feel like personal space is what's gotten in the way of us making work together?
But strangely, when we share personal space, we don't make work, or at least that's what history shows.
Well, that's not true.
What I stopped doing around Bangkok Theater Festival, I stopped entering projects into festivals and booking venues without a show existing. And I stopped self-producing when Max and Sheldon died. And my mother would say that's because my benefactors have passed away and that I have no safety net, and that was proven by the debt incurred in Values Americans Live By, which, you know, didn't have to tour to Asia on my credit card. But generally, when I think about making work in the future, it feels like, for example, Exotic Products was sort of in dialogue with you, even though you weren't a part of the process. I felt like Exotic Products used the Values of Americans Live By, aesthetic quite a lot, and I know pieces you did with
LDSM.
LDSM. I almost said LFSD. LSD. Also worked in that aesthetic, and I guess when I think about the future, I have a roster of projects in mind that I would like to make at least one or two of before I die. And, you know, the million-dollar question for me these days is, you know, how and where to live so that more work can be made, so that what happened this year doesn't happen again. And, yeah, so I don't want so I'm 39 now. I think the last 28 or so years, I've made a decent amount of work for someone who's never paid the bills as a professional artist. But recently, the yoga career has mushroomed into this full life absorbing profession, which, though not inherently negating opportunities for performance, has somewhat, brought me, for example, to Hong Kong, become the way in which I interact with most people most of the time, and is very unsatisfying artistically.
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting knot to think about. About how the expectation or the hope for financial stability both, drives the choices that you're making and drives you away from theater, right, in one way or another.
Yes, I think I now feel quite clear that the way I used to travel and live until about 2004 with the Lonesome West Namaste Theater in Los Angeles, just before the Values Americans Live 5,
mm-hmm.
actually in the midst of when I was come back from India and doing it as a solo and turned it into a trio in LA before we made our trio.
Right.
All that happened just at the end of Sheldon's life, and I was living on Mike and Robin's couch in LA and willing essentially to continue moving around like that.
Who is in the trio in LA? Colin and Olivia?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Mike directed.
Yeah.
And so 2004 was basically the last time that I felt really comfortable traveling rough, living on couches and floors, going wherever projects asked me to go. And what I haven't been, I suppose, willing to do since then is the kind of incurring debt or setting up a career in something very modular, like waiting tables or something. And that has sort of driven a stake into the heart of our collaboration over the last 6 to 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that like my memory is that that's where a lot of tension came up for us when we first moved in here. And what's hard to reconstruct, I guess, is I think for me, like you say, that it was an exciting moment, in early 2005, and partially it was exciting, I think, because we were sort of going to kind of emotional extremes after both of our fathers died, and we'd sort of had a couple of pretty crazy years of travel, and I had just been nomadic for a year, and you had just, across, the U.S. and Mexico, and you had just been nomadic for a year or more across the U.S. and India and
Canada,
right? Yeah.
Thailand.
What's that?
Thailand, Canada, India, U.S.
Yeah. So, so I had this sense of discovery, and I had this sense of sort of like, I don't know, I had this, I think it's always been really paradoxical for me is that I had this real, sense of excitement about making work together with you and with Barbara, and I remember feeling something similar when you came back to Arcosanti, right, when we'd sort of like split up after Beautiful Losers, and I'd moved back to Arcosanti, and then you and Gretchen showed up at Arcosanti, and all of the crazy things that happened that fall happened, and then you ended up leaving, and again I sort of felt like I felt really left behind, but then at the same time I think that like gave me the space to make a home at Arcosanti and feel like that was like a place that that I was living on my own terms or something, in some way. And then when we moved back to Chicago, I had this similar sense of like excitement about making work together, but I think also this like protectiveness about not wanting to feel like I was too dependent on that structure or too dependent on you. And I think I also had this sense that like you and Barbara were like the professionals and that I didn't, and that I was sort of like I'd been doing all these non-theater things, you know, both, like, poetry and writing, but also just, like, traveling and politics and, you know, all of these other things that, you know, that made me not a real theater artist or something, or a kind of...
But you got marijuana legalized.
I don't know if that's exactly what I did, but I mean, I also remember, you know, when we were... when we moved back in here and we sort of confronted actually starting to make new work, right, rather than remount the values Americans live by, that was where we really hit the crossroads, right? And I felt like the crossroads, was around, you know, you wanting to be sort of structurally and financially sound. These were how it was expressed, right? You wanting to be structurally and financially sound, Barbara wanting to engage in a kind of extended practice that wasn't geared towards product necessarily, and me wanting to sort of capture the lightning in the bottle, I guess, of like whatever happens when we get in the room and start trying to make something, you know, and. You know, not really naming it and not really trying to tame it, but, you know, but just kind of, you know, fighting and, you know, and working through it and somehow work popping out of that, right? Like work coming as a result of that. And I just remember us, like, going around and around in those conversations. And I don't know. It's hard to reconstruct if, you know, we were... if it was really just like we were in three different ideological places about making theater and how we wanted to make theater, or if we were all just sort of really like emotionally devastated by different experiences and like, you know, using these kinds of ideological shields to not deal with how difficult it was to come together in the same room and deal with each other, people that we had really long histories, you know, between us and, you know, sort of be present, I guess, right, in some way. I was afraid that the only way I was ever going to do anything was with you, and that therefore if you weren't there to do something with, I would never do anything.
Au contraire, look what's happened.
Right, I mean, you know, so again, it's the same, you know, there's a way in which the dynamic is similar to what happened, you know, when you left Arcosanti, which is, you left Chicago, and, you know, like, you know, we had talked for, you know, a decade about how, what it would be like if we moved back to Chicago, and how we would probably stay here for a really long time, and, you know, make a life here, and, you know, and integrate ourselves into the city of Chicago, and, you know, we moved back, and you were here for about 2.5 years or something, and then moved to Paris, and then I stayed, and that's sort of what I've done, right? So, I mean, I think it's with that past that I hear your, you know, your desire and your proposal to move somewhere, you know, the possibility of moving somewhere, starting this conversation again, starting making work again, right? It's intriguing to me, but I suppose I'm also, like, protective of the work that I have made, of, you know, my autonomy, and also, like, mistrustful, I suppose, of, like, our ability to do that, right? Like, because it was so hard for us to do it last time, and I still don't know, you know, and I'm still sort of working through why it was so hard for us to do, right?
I mean, if we were only... like homosexual and knew it in high school, you know, then, you know, maybe we could be like so many, you know, collaborators who are also lovers, who are also a couple, who also make work, you know. Certainly the imaginary gay version of me and you has no relationship drama whatsoever. Probably want an ice cube to chew on when I say this. And,
I don't know that that's a solution, right? Like,
right. But my point is that at least my relationship dramas with Charlotte and Kenna and you know, whomever at the time would have been with you.
it wouldn't have taken us away from each other's presence, is what you're saying.
Right. Or it wouldn't have happened at all, because it would have been a harmonious love story.
Somehow I think that's pretty doubtful.
You think I would have been unfaithful?
Well, I'm certain that you would have been unfaithful.
Wow. That's heavy. That's really heavy.
But I doubt that would be the primary issue.
How do we get to the present and the future?
Well, we're in the present. What do you think of the future?
Well, I have this roster of projects that I keep kind of like running tabs on, you know, like I have various documents and journals and things with projects listed that I tell myself have a potential of happening, you know, that I would like to see happen. One thing I'm kind of constantly confused by is like, I almost everywhere I go think about remounting Beautiful Losers. And I often think like, am I allowed to do that without the LEC? Am I allowed to do it without Ira? Like, you know, I don't doubt my ability to make work happen when I'm making work happen, and I don't doubt my sort of hunches about projects, but over the last 10 years it's become nearly impossible for me to make anything happen in the theater. And when I think about the future, and I look at, for example, projects that I've written down that I would like to work on, you know, and I wonder how many of them interest you or involve you or make you feel like it's even relevant or worthwhile. And so I have this list of adaptations, Beautiful Losers being one that I would always like to remount. The Collector by John Fowles, another. True Hallucinations being an account of the author's extraordinary adventures in the Devil's Paradise.
Right. I think that one was my idea.
That was your idea. The Dictionary of the Khazars. Then existing plays, Forever and a Day, The Designated Mourner, Attempts on Her Life, and other, The Left Hand of Darkness, adapted from Ursula Le Guin as an opera. Corpse Posers, the television show about yoga, medicine, addiction, and depression.
Oh yeah, I didn't know you were still holding on to that one.
Yeah, I took a meeting with a producer in Hong Kong about that one, actually.
Oh, wow.
Ecotopia, a film adaptation of Ernest Callenbach's novel. And then, you might remember I sent this to you and Barbara, and it's completely formless, but Glance Back at Angry Men.
Glance Back at Angry Men?
Glance Back in Angry Men.
I don't know what that is.
An experimental hybrid assemblage of fragments from Robert Wilson, John Osborne, Reginald Rose. So it's Death Man's Glance, plus Look Back in Anger, plus 12 Angry Men.
I'm most interested in that one.
What a surprise. That is an interesting one, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not necessarily even that familiar with the source text, but I like that there are multiple sources and that they make no sense together.
Yeah. Glance Back in Angry Men. Oh, and I forgot one. I think I told you about this idea. Kind of, this is probably one of the only money-making ideas I've ever had in performance. Put a series of blast furnaces, glory holes on a stage, so the tour has to be able to tour glory holes for glass blowing.
Yeah.
Let's say three of them, for example. And then to audition and work with glass blowers who have, you know, movement skills, whether it's, you know, capoeira or dance or whatever, think a little bit like Stahl. but wherein the primary light sources are the blast furnaces, and glass pieces are made live on stage in front of the audience in some kind of rhythmic performance way. Maybe this has some fantasy sort of aesthetic relation to Jelly Eye. And then to sell the objects that they make to the audience after the show. And it's called Glassed Blowing.
It's called Glassed Blowing?
Blast Glowing.
Blast Glowing.
Blast Glowing.
Gotcha. Wow. I mean, those are a lot of projects.
Yeah, those are a lot of projects, and I'm making headway on all of them.
Where I think we could probably pretty clearly say, like, you know, here's something that there's a space, you know, to work on together, and here's something that seems like it's an Aaron Cotton project, you know, in one way or another, right? Like I'd enjoy going to that glass blowing show. I don't know what role I might play in the glass blowing show in any way, shape, or form.
Well, and I worry that future iterations of Beautiful Losers that I might want to produce would offend you, or if they didn't include you, somehow even incur your desire to see them not happen. You know, I continue with this fantasy idea of building some kind of longhouse and putting the show in the longhouse, and I'm struggling with whether or not I want that longhouse to be a real longhouse or kind of a architectural form of the longhouse completely in white with external and internal video mapping to create all the various scenes and changes of scenes and lighting and, you know, and I think, you know, like, as soon as, and often I think the version we made is actually the best anyway. The full puppet concept would not be better, and the video mapping longhouse version would not be better. And that we should just remap more, but just, you know, produce it more seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always that tension is always there between the possible versions of things that we imagine and the versions that we are able to actualize and to make happen, right? And I think, you know, I think to some extent, I don't really have much faith in my theatrical imagination. My idea of theater is very, like, simple and elemental and doesn't involve these kinds of, like, fantastical imaginings of what might, you know, of, like, pushing the edge of possibility or something, right?
But meanwhile, you make theater, and all I do is imagine this shit. I don't ever make anything.
Right, so, that's sort of an extreme way of putting it, but, I mean, there is a way in which, you know, I think what, you know, what I'm interested in is starting with something and then going through a process by which that thing becomes something else, right? Rather than realizing a vision that somebody or other might have had at some point in the past, right?
I think we agree on that more than we disagree. I mean, now I'm auditioning for a rock band on Monday and Legally Blonde in January.
What?
Yeah. That's how desperate I am to make sure I do perform in 2018. I thought, okay, well, you know, I like to sing and going on here, you know. I mean, when I wrote at the beginning of my email, luckily I found some time in my mostly unscheduled day. Thursdays I'm a little bit busy, Mondays I'm a little bit busy, most days I'm not very busy. Like, I usually teach 2 classes a day, maybe 3. You know, talking like between 2.5 and 4 hours of work per day. I do have to sometimes clean the apartment when the cleaning lady can't come. and sometimes I have to walk the dog.
Yeah.
I usually do the laundry. It's usually my thing. But I'm also watching a lot of television, which I find hard to find worthwhile television. But I think if I were more of a writer, I'd probably have more of a career. But all these projects require writing, and I've always depended on you to write what I'm thinking. And then you go and get all busy with a writing MFA, and then this fucking PhD seems to have a lot of writing involved. So you're a very busy person with other things to write with deadlines, and they give you...
Right, and the secret is I sort of really dislike writing, right? I think in some ways, you know, what I'm in pursuit of is collective making, right? Maybe the gap between the lived experience of collectivity and the work coming out of it narrowing, you know, increasingly narrow, you know, becoming increasingly narrower so that they happen at the same time. Excuse me. You know. But you make work in the way that you're able to make work in the life that you have, you know. Which I guess is to say that, you know, were you to show up where I am, we might make work together. Were you to not show up where I am, we might make work together as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's something stunted in our historic unwillingness to do what needs to be done to create the institution that can make work. And that, I think, is something that it's hard for me to not judge it as a negative or a misstep or some kind of accident or bad idea, you know. But at this point, as I said in my letter, I think having a recurring schedule of interaction with you about performance might be satisfying enough, even if it were about other people's performances, saying, like, you know, we just had a podcast where we reviewed and talked about and interviewed people around Chicago performance, that could be satisfying enough for me.
Yeah.
And it becomes even clearer in Hong Kong, because I've come here to teach yoga and to share my passion for yoga with people, but actually I have the least responsive students I've ever encountered in my life. So I literally walk in, I say good afternoon, and there is silence. There'll be 35 students in the room. Nobody says good afternoon. You know, so like, the way in which I've been brought here to share my passion for yoga, teach yoga, and been given an essentially anonymous, silent, often disengaged audience to share that with proves to me that sharing it with someone or people who actually want to engage it is what makes it interesting. That just speaking yoga instructions to a room full of people who do it more or less but don't actually turn it into a Socratic experience is very, very flat for me.
Yeah.
It doesn't tick the box. It doesn't fulfill that need at all.
Hold that thought. I need to relieve myself.
Oh, really? I did that during the conversation.
Did you really?
I did. I filled these two vessels with urine while we spoke.
Well, I'm going to go in the bathroom. I'll be right back.
I didn't know that was allowed. I didn't know that was part of the deal. Well, meanwhile, while Ira's away, I'm going to send a WhatsApp message here. And I suppose I should take this opportunity to say, in case this makes it into the piece, I really wish I could be there and not have this other person reading my voice. I doubt probably that the performance would be nearly as interesting to the audience if the guest artist were not there reading my voice, but nevertheless, that doesn't change my desire to be there instead of the guest artist.
Are you still talking?
Yes.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the technology of podcasting is the perfect technology for two people who are in on different continents, as opposed to the technology of theater. And maybe one way to, you know, begin that process is to move away from thinking about making theater and talking about theater as two different things. And maybe, you know, maybe it's an extension of this conversation, right? Like, maybe it's an extension of the what kind of work have we made together and how might we make work together in the future conversation, and, you know, and then we can also fight.
Publicly,
right. I mean, not in a, you know, fake way. Like, only when we really want to fight.
I guess I tend to think like, I think I was living a lot of my life until now, and maybe I still am, in something of a delusion that I was exceptional, you know, that I was going to be rich or famous or magically successful or somehow have a kind of a Simon McBurney, Johnny Depp sort of career that would just sort of materialize, you know, where it would all be very naturally flowing from one interesting thing to another, and the theater company would evolve and the money would be there. And I think now I'm thinking, you know, clearly that didn't happen. And after my last experience in LA and the one before that and the one before that, I don't really want to subject myself to that again. So I think there's wisdom in, you know, just for integrating like Alex did in Los Angeles, like you did in Chicago. And again, I thought perhaps something like that might happen in Lecoq for me in Paris or Europe. But since nothing has materialized for me in that way and I haven't made it happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think we suffer from the same versions of the same malady. You know, this early understanding of ourselves as exceptional. You know, it has made me less nimble, less able to deal with, you know, with reality as it is, and to, you know, yeah, to kind of be, you know, do the best I can, right? Rather than do the best anybody could ever have done, right? you know, and I think, you know, I think that, you know, I think that's been really true for me as an artist, and it's been really true for me as an academic, right? Is that, like, my ideas of what I should be capable of get in the way of actually doing what I am capable of, right? And that's what I mean of, like, starting from the circumstances that we're in, you know, and figuring out how to do what we can do with what we have financially, geographically, temporally, you know.
What's frustrating about that is, for some weird reason, some of the first work I made as a director really was potentially some of the best work I've ever made or ever will make. You know, the last almost 20 years have not disproved it, you know, from the time of, let's say Van Gogh was 20 years ago. You know, like, that was the first show that I technically produced, technically as an artistic director, and it was a really powerful show, and Mud was 2 years later, and it was a really powerful show, and Beautiful Losers was 3 years later, and it was a really powerful show, and in the last 20 years, those things further back are the things which sort of stand out as exceptional, and also as sort of attended or structured and seen and made. And watching La Flora del Baos here in Hong Kong do this show they call MERS really reminded me of Experiment Goes Public, just done on a grand scale with a lot of money and funding, but like, you know, what the audience was reacting to, like, oh my god, this is so crazy, and like, I've never been anything like this, and oh my god, wow, like my friend who I was with, this favorite harp singer from England, she was like, I can't understand how they even came up with this. And I was like, this reminds me so much of my work almost 20 years ago. And, you know, she's like, but how? How can you even think to make something like this? And I was explaining to her how we did this stuff. And she's like, oh, that sounds so similar. And, you know, it's, I guess, like, I don't feel old except when I think about sleeping on people's floors and couches.
Right.
Very surprised. I'm regularly surprised to find myself living in Hong Kong. Almost every day I walk around in a kind of haze or disbelief to a certain degree, and sometimes it's pleasant. I mean, sometimes I really find it great being here, but most of the time I think, like, this place makes sense if you are a trader or a banker or a lawyer or into hedge funds or something like that, but to not be Chinese or Chinese-speaking here, these, you know, groups that are doing things that interest me that are like work I'd like to do, but, you know, they're primarily people who met each other in university here, they're primarily Chinese, and, you know, I definitely feel like an outsider, and I don't expect to learn Cantonese or be here long enough to learn Cantonese. You know, I tend not to think I'll be here very long. So it's hard to grow where I'm planted. But I would like to. Not because I want to stay here and put down roots here, but because I'm tired of not growing where I'm planted.
Right. I mean, I think my version of that is that I keep trying to think, resist the thinking that sees everything I do as preparatory, right? Like, I think I've gone through many years of my life imagining that I'm preparing for something when I'm good at something in the future.
Yeah.
And rather, I'd like to sort of acknowledge that what I'm doing right now is the thing that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Thanks. I told you you're going to have to edit the gallbladder out of this.
I will. All right. I'm going to end our conversation after.
I'd like to thank my voice this evening.
Whoever that may be.
All right, dude.
I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.
Thank you, eh?
My pleasure, Ira. I'll see you in the potosphere.
Lots of love.
Love you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.